session number 9876, reel 7.
Mr. Dennis, reel 7. We were talking about your role in the forward observation post. I wondered whether you ever had to liaise during an infantry attack, because this was during the Ypres offensive, 3rd Ypres.
I was never in the forward observation post at a time of an attack. During the Third Battle of Ypres, things were different later, as I'll come to. Anyone who came to it. But during the Third Battle of Ypres, I was only acting as FOO in the intervals between attacks when both sides were indulging in harassing fire on each other. Then it seemed to me pretty sticky. It wasn't the same as when there was an actual attack. So I considered myself lucky.
How was it decided who would be in the FOO during an attack? Because there were attacks.
Well, as a matter of fact, sometimes the brigade commander or maybe the battery commander would himself pick a chap he thought right. At other times, it would be simply the person whose turn it was. If it was my turn, if on the 20th of September, when we had an attack, if it had been my turn to be there, I suppose I should have seen it. Or alternatively, if the brigadier had said to my battery commander, make sure that there's a reliable man. All this arises more after, in 1918, when in fact I was selected to be FOO. Because there was a German attack.
So you weren't on your own, I believe, at the FOO. You'd have your signal.
Two signallers, usually. And the point was that the shellfire would continually be cutting the lines. And they could only be repaired by sending the signallers along. They used to go and test the line at intervals and find out where the break was and mend it by hand. It was quite easy to mend the surface lines. But the trouble was that by the time they got back to the FOO, probably the shellfire would have broken the thing again. So communication was never satisfactory until I don't think it was ever satisfactory during the 1914-18 war.
So you'd often be out of touch with your battery?
Very often. And you had to get back into touch as soon as you could. This involved sending signallers to go out, leave the post, go out in the open, and go back along the line. And we none of us liked this, because it seemed to be putting the signallers into danger. Inevitably, we couldn't avoid doing so. But we were safer in the post than they were in the open. And you had a feeling that if one of them got killed, in a way, it might be your fault.
Did any of them get killed?
Yes. In anticipating, two of my signallers got wounded on their way to the observation post in March 1918.
Did they mind going out? I mean, would they? What was their attitude when you sent them out into shell fire?
This is a job you're ordered to do. You just got to do it. And they did. I never had any sensation that the man was hanging back or anything like that. the sensation was perhaps more in my mind that I was sorry I'd got to send him out.
What equipment were you using? What did they have with them?
They went back with a telephone, with a field telephone. The signallers had with them a telephone which they could tap into the line at intervals and so locate the break, because they would be able to, having tapped the phone into some point of the line, speak to me at the FOO and speak to the battery if the line was intact. If one of those two didn't do, the line was broken. So they had to go on further and see if they could get the battery from there. Then between the first position and the second would be the break. It was quite simple, but very frustrating, because the breaks followed one another so quickly.
The telephone, it was you spoke to them over the line then, did you? Would you actually speak to them, or would the signaller speak to them? I mean, when the equipment was actually working.
Oh, well, I would speak ordinarily, but they would speak to each other sometimes in the process of mending the line. But for tactical things, to say whether it looked like another German attack or something like that, the officer would do it.
What was the reception like on the line?
Well, it was terribly bad if the line was at all rotten. But when you got the line all right, or for the brief periods when the line was all right, it wasn't a bad reception at all. You could hear pretty well what was going on.
How would it compare to a modern telephone, 1987? Sort of variety.
Oh, not so good, of course, as that thing by your side, but not bad, not bad.
Did you have any other duties in the FOO?
Well, of course, if you noticed anything happening that was significant, particularly if you noticed any movement on the German side, you'd certainly telephone it through to the battery, and if it was more than local significance, they would get on to the brigade. And all this is again anticipating what happened on the.
We'll come to that.
Yes.
What about the local infantry battalions? Would you see much of them, or would your post be fairly separate from them?
We generally had a post. If there were trenches there, we would have a post in the trenches probably near company headquarters of the infantry. We would have our own hole, so to speak. In the 3rd Battery of Ypres, I had a post which was an enlarged shell hole, because there were no trenches, we were just where the lads had
stopped.
You
mentioned that, yes.
And there we actually shared it with some London infantry. They didn't, I think, very much care to have us there, because we were inclined to look over the top and tend to give the place away. And also, I think the infantry often felt that we would start a bombardment which, of course, would come back on us. So, though I can't say I ever came out on unpleasantness, one did sense that they would rather you weren't there.
Now, you were in the FOO, I think you said earlier, off the tape, for a day and a night, usually, or a night.
Sometimes you were brought in at nightfall, and sometimes you were left during the night.
Now, you also mentioned, when we were talking about your duties, that you then had a day or a night with the battery. Do you think you could run through your duties when you were staying with the battery?
Well, I would arrive at about breakfast time, I think, and my batman would come with me and probably carry an extra Macintosh for me, and also some food, which he would heat up during the day, lunchtime. I would go around. First, I would start in the battery dugout. That was the nerve center from where the phones were. There would be probably a trecher bed. If for any officer who had to spend the night there, there would be a chap called the BCA, the Battery Commander's Assistant, who was a rather educated gunner who could work out from gun tables and so on. Very useful chaps, because you don't want the officer who ought to be have his wits about him, in fact, looking at the guns. You don't want him engaged in a lot of mathematics. Better to have a, probably also the BCA would probably be better at it. So he would be there. Well, having looked round there and spoken to the outgoing officer, say anything happened during the night? No, we had the usual harassing fire, but nothing came our way. Then I'd go round to the gun pits and talk to the men in the gun pits and see where they seemed to be all right. There might be a new lot who came up with me, or we might work the change over differently. But
would the men stay? How long would the men be there for?
Oh, I think they would be there under 24 hour, on and then back.
Back to the billet.
So I know. I'm not too sure of this.
Now, a point you wanted to make was that we said earlier that we were at Canal Bank and then moved to St. Julian, but in actual fact, I think you now remember...
We had an intermediate position, much more important, short of St. Julian, further than the position was the Admiral Road position, and it was practically where the German front line had been. It was nearer... That was called Hilltop, but I can't now remember exactly how it ran, except that there was this road which you could just see, covered with mud and filth and so on, but it was there. And the pits, we could only dig a little way down in the Australians. Mostly the gun pits were really sandbag. So we put they would stop a splinter, but of course nothing would help if they got direct hit. There was no way of doing anything about a direct hit anywhere.
So this was a position. This is
Admiral's Road.
Now, when you got looking at the other end of the telephone wire, so to speak, from your other duties, what would happen? Who would take the call? When you had the call come through from an FOO, say on a registry, if they were registering, who would receive that information?
Well, there would be a signaller always in the battery dugout, and he would take the call, say, call for you, sir, or he might be something, you might say, no, Charlie, you better go out and have another look. There's something about the line. Or he'd say, call for you, sir. And the officer in the forward observing would say, what can he something he had to say. That's the way that that would run.
And how would you pass the information to the guns? I mean, oh, so for the registering?
Well, you could do one of two things. You could stand outside the battery dugout with a megaphone and shout. You could, we didn't always use a megaphone, but you could. Number three gun, up 1 degree, 20 minutes, or something like that. And they could shout back to you, number three gun ready, sir. Well, you might fire it, or the fellow in the FOO might tell you when to fire it. But I told you there were two ways. He could fire the guns, or the man, or he could observe, and the man in charge of the battery could do the firing.
Right. Besides firing the guns, were you responsible for supervising the maintenance of the guns and whether they were in fact working properly? Because you said a lot of them weren't very good.
Oh, I didn't mean that they weren't working right. What I meant was that their accuracy was not very good. And that was a matter of ammunition more often. No, the man who would be most concerned with the working, the proper working of the gun, would be the sergeant in charge of that gun pit. And he would keep a careful look at whether the thing was coming back properly after firing. You see, it goes like that when it's brought back.
The hydraulics, then?
Yes, yes. The buffer will bring it. It'll go back on, and then the reciprocator will send it forward. Well, the sergeant will mostly look at that. If he thinks there's something wrong, he'd tell me, and I'd go and have a look. But I wouldn't know very much technically about the machinery, because if it was a real technical fault, they used to send someone up from the ordnance who would be a real expert in machinery, and he would have a look, and maybe he would say, no, it's no good, you'll have to, this gun will have to go back, and it would be taken out at night and another one brought in. That would happen. But the gunner officer had to know a certain amount about the working, but he couldn't be an expert on all the machinery.
So you'd be more just checking,
yes,
that it was wrong. You'd sort of,
yes,
look at it and say, yes, that's definitely wrong.
See that it was definitely wrong. Say, had you noticed this before, Sergeant? How long? And he'd say, no, it was all right till, but yesterday I began to be doubtful about it. Something like that. That kind of conversation would go on.
Did you have any other duties when you were on the battery for that day or 24 hours or whatever?
I'm just trying to think what else I could. Was to carry out any fire program that we'd been given from brigade.
This is on the map references.
Yes, you'd have to.
You wouldn't be consulting the FOO then, would you? Presumably.
No. You'd tell him that you were firing and... But if you're on the battery when there is an offensive, when we're doing an offensive, you will have a program with various lifts so that the barrage will creep forward and the infantry will follow the barrage. We hope close to, because it's more dangerous to have a gap than to have an occasional stray shell that's falling short. But of course it's easy to say that when you're not infantry.
Was it difficult to follow these fire programs?
Well, not very. I mean, we would have all the elevations and the line for each gun laid down and all on paper, and perhaps you'd get a message in the course of the fire that something was going wrong on one of the guns. It wasn't going quite right. Possibly the trail had, at the back of the gun had gone and embedded itself in the soil, which was very easy in Ypres. And the sergeant would say that he couldn't follow the program for the time being, so they used to get men, and if necessary more men, to dig the trail out and get it back. So that gun would be temporarily out of action, and its part in the barrage would be missing. So you wanted to get it back quickly.
How much firing would be done in one of these barrages? Would the guns be going continuously for or what?
Well, I was thinking one of the offensives. I seem to remember that we had about 400 rounds to fire from early in the morning to when the barrage reached its point, after which we would go to prearranged firing. We could either have a curtain, we hoped it would be a curtain between the infantry and the Germans, or some of the guns would be put to firing on suspected German gun positions.
So that's in that 400 rounds, that's roughly 100 rounds per gun in a day. During these a major offensive.
Yes, during that. Otherwise, I suppose each gun in the course of the day might fire, say, 50 rounds harassing fire.
How long would the barrels last? Because they have to be rebuilt.
Oh yes, we had to have the guns removed at intervals. The ordnance would bring a new one up, and the ordnance man would take one back. In fact, again anticipating a bit, when we had all the guns hit, two of them were taken away, and we had only two guns for a few days.
Did you, besides the information coming through from the FOO and occasional, I suppose, appeals for help from the infantry, would
the infantry wouldn't appeal to us? They would have no means of communicating with us. But the forward observing officer, who would be with the infantry, he would say, "We're getting a great deal of fire coming from," and he'd try to give a map, a compass bearing, if he possibly could. And well, there are occasions on which you could sometimes relieve infantry a bit by firing on German batteries, which you knew about. But that wasn't not a fair picture of what went on in the middle of the Battle of Ypres. It was all far too much confusion for that sort of thing.
Did you ever have any, during the Ypres, were you ever in, did you have aircraft spotting for you?
Oh, yes, rather. We had quite a lot of fire. Our own planes, of course, were reconnaissance planes and were slow and extremely vulnerable. And it was rather a dreadful business that they were pounced on and shot down by German fighters whilst they were lumbering about trying to observe for us. They really had a hell of a time, the RAF, during April 19. During the whole of 1917, the Germans were well on top.
How did you communicate with the spotter plane?
Ah, well, that was that. Now, I tell you, there was no way that we could communicate directly with the spotter plane, except by signals on the ground, and that was large strips of canvas, perhaps as long as this room.
About 10 yards?
Yes. Which we used to lay out, every CI for come in and this kind of thing. And he could see them. On the other hand, he could send us signals. Whether they were Morse or not, I don't know, but I can't remember. But the spotted plane could send signals to us, and we couldn't send signals to him. And we knew the danger they were in, which was very considerable. And we always wanted badly to get the program through so that the poor man could come in. Because if he was out any length of time, we knew he'd get chopped down. In parenthesis, on occasions during, on our day at the billets when we were free of specific duties, we went to visit the aerodromes, as they call them in those days, where our spotted planes were, and we could talk to the chaps. And I got a powerful impression of the bad time they were having. They were losing terribly fast.
What was their morale like?
Well, they went out and they went round. If they went shot down, they came back. But
they didn't seem to be depressed about it.
Oh, I think they were depressed, all right. I think they couldn't fail to be depressed because they were having the worst of it all the time. You see, the Germans, our Air Force authorities kept our planes continually over the German lines, however many they lost. The Germans were much more careful about sending planes over us. They did, but they sent strong fighter escorts and that kind of thing. We used to see a bit of this from the ground.
Would you have considered taking it, going into the RFC, or
I mean,
a lot of people.
I thought to myself that I haven't got the courage to go into the RAF. First of all, I had no aptitude for games, and that means that my sight would have been accepted, of course. That's the short answer. But even if I had been acceptable, I'm afraid I wouldn't have had the guts.
Now, I believe there was once an incident when you were in charge of a battery. You were left in charge.
Yes.
When the battery was badly shelled.
Yes.
Could you take me right through the whole story? Because it illustrates several.
Yes, indeed, I could. Lots of things happened. I arrived in the morning at the battery position, the battery being at the Admiral's Road site, where we had the old German trench running quite close to us. And we had we made a bit of the old German trench into our own battery dugout, which was a little safer than the bare sandbags would have been. And I arrived in the morning with my batman, and I came with a colleague of mine who was slightly older than me, ought to have been senior, but he wasn't. I told you about that imbroglio, but it never made any difference between us. And we found the major in command of the battery, who'd been stopping at the battery for a long time, and he looked out, and it was a filthy day, raining. Well, it's always raining, and he said it's raining more than usual, and he said, I don't think there's a chance of German air observation today. They just won't be able to do it in this weather. I think I'll get a motorcycle and go into Poppering and get my hair cut. And Poppering was our sort of wicked city. So off he went, and Vernon, the other subaltern, and I sat down and we did a little odd firing. We had the usual what they called harassing program. We used to fire on what was thought to be possible places would be awkward for the Germans, like crossroads and things like that. And about lunchtime I heard a noise which I recognised, because I was now able to recognise what it was. I recognised that it was probably a German 5.9 howitzer on the way. And so we there was the usual shock and explosion and so on, and it was in front of the battery position, rather too close, but still it was perfectly possible it might have been a German.